Welcome, welcome. Episode 48 of the Phoenix Suns podcast here on Bright Side of the Sun. Chris Habas, as always. Jim Kokenauer is riding co-pilot with me here tonight on a Monday night, actually recording this, that you're catching it on a Tuesday. We're doing that on purpose. We're actually, as you listen to the podcast, there's going to be a pretty cool contest that we're going to drop. The contest itself is not cool, but the prize is definitely worth it. So the contest, you'll get it here somewhere midway through. Just keep listening to the podcast, and we'll drop that in there as we're talking. But other than that, Jim, tomorrow night, or tonight, I should say, for folks listening, Phoenix Suns, Los Angeles Lakers, more importantly, Phoenix Suns and Kobe Bryant. That's got to get the blood flowing a little bit, no matter which heat pattern it's boiling in. It's got to get the blood flowing, right?
It does, and this is podcast 48, and 48 points is the last highest amount that Kobe Bryant has scored in a game against the Phoenix Suns. That was actually January 1st, 2012. Kobe hit 48 against Phoenix, and he has not hit that mark again since then. So podcast 48, Kobe 48, and I would be surprised to see him go for 48 again in the game Tuesday night.
Yeah, and since you mentioned 48, I wanted to play with that a little bit as well. 48, hello Arizona, the 48th state in the United States, as well as 48 minutes in a regulation basketball game. So we're going to get, we're not going to get 48 minutes of Kobe. We're going to get 48 minutes of basketball tomorrow. But as you mentioned, episode 48's got a lot of meanings there with Kobe's high point total in the past 4 to 5 games against the Suns, as well as this being the 48th state. So you're welcome, Brightsiders. We just educated you. You learn something new every day. And if you learn that on this podcast, that says something about the Arizona educational system. Am I right?
Absolutely. Best in the nation.
So we were coming at you early, like I said, because of the podcast, also because of Kobe. Kobe dictates our lives. That's kind of how things work. I'm sure everybody, I don't know what the ratings were, but I'm pretty sure everyone under the sun tuned into the game last night against the Toronto Raptors. Probably the first time the Toronto Raptors were on TV and it was must-see basketball because of the Darth Vader return of Kobe Bryant. What were your takes on Kobe's return? It wasn't flashy. We all have seen the numbers and hopefully seen the game to an extent. What was your thought on Kobe's comeback?
He looked rusty. I didn't watch the entire game, but I must admit, shamefully enough, that I did catch the second half, and he looked about like you'd expect a player to look after that prolonged, protracted of a layoff due to the injury, getting back in there. So it'll probably take a little bit of time for him to get back into the flow of things, and he's got new teammates that he's working with out there, and they're adjusting to him too, since he's going to be back out there kind of being the primary ball handler. Kobe Bryant kind of has his own gravitational force out there. So whether he dominates the ball or whether you want to call him a ball stopper, however that works, whatever kind of metaphor you want to use, whether you think it's a good thing or a bad thing, that's the kind of player he is. And, yeah, he's just going to have to shake off the rest, and hopefully he doesn't shake off the rest against Phoenix.
Yeah, and one thing that I hope folks aren't expecting is that Kobe's going to come out and dominate. This whole podcast is not going to be Kobe-centric. We're not silver screening and rolling on you guys with this being a Laker podcast. But when you look at a star returning, so Kobe Bryant, he should have been out way longer, but the guy is a robot. He's cut from the same cloth of the Terminator and those folks out there from those movies. But when you look at a star coming back, and me and you, Jim, we've watched basketball for a while. You clearly have watched way more basketball than me because you're much older than I am. But when it comes to basketball, whether you're a great player or you're just an average player, when you're introducing a new element to a lineup that has had a chance to create chemistry like the Lakers have, it's going to throw things off. I mean, the Chicago Bulls, we saw that this season. They started off 1-3 with Derrick Rose in his return, and then they went off and ran off about 4 or 5 wins. And then he went down with injury again, unfortunately. But those are the kind of things, the hot and the cold, the good with the bad. It's going to take a little bit for Kobe to get his NBA legs underneath him. How long do you expect this to take? Because clearly against the Suns on Tuesday, if he goes out there and he drops 30, no one's going to be surprised. But on the flip side, if he goes out there and has 8 or 9 points, 8 turnovers, a couple assists, a couple of rebounds like he did against Toronto, no one's going to be surprised as well, right?
Yeah, it's going to take a little bit of time, I think. In that game, the starters in that game, they scored 23 points. I think it was 23 points on 8 out of 32 shooting. It was the bench that actually went for 71. And Steve Blake had been the primary ball handler leading up to that game, and I think he'd had double-digit assists in 6 out of 8 games, something like that. Maybe that could be wrong, but if my memory serves me. So they had a really different dynamic, and they also had a dynamic where they'd had 8 different players score at least 20 points in a game over a 6-2 stretch heading into that game last night. They've been 6-2 over their last 8 games. And so this was a loss with Kobe's first game back. So they've been, whether you want to call it sharing the wealth or whether you want to call it having a different guy kind of step up every night, whatever you want to say that mechanic was with that team. But they've been spreading the ball around, having a lot of these different people step up. And now you've got Kobe. And whether these guys are going to concede to Kobe, defer to Kobe, how that's going to work, where the trust level is with how Kobe can depend on these guys. He doesn't have, a ton of experience with some of these guys that had some new additions. It's obviously a different team than it was last year. So it'll be interesting to see how that feeling out process is. And I'm not going to say, I don't know that this team necessarily ever really comes together. I think it's a playoff team with Kobe Bryant, but I don't think that they're a threat to anyone. So coming together from now being maybe slightly below average and the feeling out process to maybe slightly above average, I don't know that you're going to necessarily see some fudroyant turnaround to where they're like struggling, and then bam, and you can see this salient difference.
Yeah, and with the Lakers this summer, obviously with Kobe being gone, they went into Band-Aid mode. They went into panic mode. They went into, let's grab as many guys that can kind of sort of replicate some of the things Kobe does at the same position. I think that's actually, I don't know if it's going to backfire on them necessarily if they go small and they can find an efficient way for these guys to play together. But when you look at the roster, Steve Blake, Steve Nash are going to be running the point when and if Steve Nash comes back. But then you have a logjam between Nick Young, Jody Meeks, Xavier Henry, Wesley Johnson, Kobe Bryant. All those guys kind of more or less play the two and the three. More effectively, all those guys play the two, actually. So when you look at all of those different players who are all between 6'4 and 6'6, 6'8 with Kobe Bryant, you have a whole bunch of shoot-first two guards, a bunch of guys that can make jumpers but aren't necessarily playmakers or distributors or pure shooters. They're all rhythm shooters, and they're guys that can catch fire, as we've seen with Nick Young, with Xavier Henry last night. You mentioned the bench being the reason why the Lakers were good last night. Xavier Henry goes off and he's playing great, and then they sub him out for Nick Young or Kobe Bryant as soon as he gets hot. And as soon as the game gets cut down to like 3, 4, or 5 points, they take him out, and then it balloons back up to 10, 12, 13 points, and all of a sudden they got to dig out of a hole. So that's the thing with the Lakers, and you're going to see that against the Suns on Tuesday out there in L.A., is that the Suns are going to be able to throw, we were talking about this before we jumped on the air, you have P.J. Tucker, who you can just say, go out there and just assault and attack and just get all over Kobe from the word go. And he's a guy that can guard him for a long time, and then they can throw different waves of guys at him, from Goran to Eric Bledsoe to a lesser extent, Archie Goodwin, Gerald Green, whole lot of athletes, different types of players they can throw at Kobe Bryant. They did the same thing last year. And last year, if you look at Kobe's totals, he didn't dominate the Suns like he usually does. He actually was a little bit off of his game because the Suns had waves of different kinds of defenders to throw at him, and that made them a little bit more successful against Kobe. I think that's kind of the game we're going to see tonight.
Yeah, it's interesting with the confluence of twos and threes that they kind of have on that team, and some of those guys being fairly athletic with Mike D'Antoni as the coach, that team isn't capitalizing on that and getting out and running a little bit more and being higher in the league in terms of fast break points, and where they could run a little bit more, get out on the fast break, and then now with Kobe coming back, have him to settle back into it in the half-court offense and have those young guys to kind of go out there at a frenetic pace and have Kobe to depend on for your crutch in the fourth quarter or when it comes to closing time. So I'm not sure what kind of team they're going to be. It's kind of a mismatch of parts. Gasol seems like he's kind of deteriorating. He's only shooting 42% from the field this year, like actually like 41.6. So it's like a really declivitous descent from his career shooting percentages. And I don't think last year he shot very well either, about 47. But before that, I think he was habitually over 50%, maybe even every year of his career up to that point. So he seems to be kind of fading. He's not the presence he was. He's not a close to 2010 guy anymore, and didn't really have much else big there. Steve Nash, even if he comes back, he seems to be a shell of his former self, and that, if anything, may just be kind of sad to see him deteriorate that way back on the court. You know, some of the younger point guards over there with Blake and Pharma and these guys, they're probably better than Steve Nash at this point of Steve's career anyway.
Yeah, and the thing with, I mean, from our generation and just watching guys in their prime, it's kind of sad in general as we're watching guys like this generation of Tim Duncan, Kevin Garnett, Kobe Bryant, Steve Nash, etc. It's sad in general watching them get old and seeing them kind of regress in overall impact in the way that they play the game. But with Kobe Bryant, so speaking of him, here is first part of the contest. I'm going to give it in a two-parter. We'll mention it again here kind of randomly throughout the podcast, so keep listening on. First part of the podcast, you have a few minutes now to think about it. First part of the contest is how many points will Kobe Bryant score tonight in the game? Second part of the contest here, we'll get at you in a handful of minutes. I'm not going to say exactly when. We'll just kind of throw it out there when there's a minute. But think about that, stew on that. He didn't have a great performance scoring-wise the other night. What do you think he's going to score tonight against the Suns, a team that he scores career-wise a quality amount? He actually gets out there for 26 a night against the Suns career-wise, but that's usually on two healthy Achilles tendons there. So we'll see kind of what he does with one kind of coming back from injury. Now, so let's...
My guess, Chris, is it's probably going to be somewhere between that 48 number I alluded to and the 4 that he scored in his last game against Phoenix. So somewhere between 48 and 4 would probably be a good range.
I'm going to go anywhere between 0 and 81. I feel like that's a pretty safe bet. Let's be serious. If I'm going to throw out a number, I can't win the contest. If I do, whoopee, but I can't. But if I'm going to throw out a number, I'm going to say I think Kobe scores about 22 points. I think he tries to be a distributor, but I think he's going to go out there and be a little more aggressive. He felt in game action what it was like to cut, move, shoot, get his shooting legs under him, etc. I think now in the second game, I think he's going to be a little bit more confident shooting the ball and attacking. Not Kobe Bryant confident, you know, from his prime, but I think he'll get out there for about 22 points and have a quality amount of assists running the offense.
That seems like a decent guess. He doesn't like Phoenix, so he's going to take some shots. So I would guess that he has a good chance to get in the 20s. So just to put a number on it, I would say 24.
Yeah, maybe he'll get 24 on 24. Or with me, maybe he'll get 22 on 22. Yeah, I mean, it's going to take some shots to get there. We'll see how efficient he is. But to transition real quick, so you mentioned kind of, we talk about the steady decline of some of the players that brought in this current era of basketball from like 95 up until about a couple of years ago when they started getting a little bit older. So recent decline in players, let's talk about recent decline and future decline or maybe future success of teams. When you look at the Los Angeles Lakers, let's talk a little bit about their situation going forward. Jim, you help me out. Which one do you want first? Do you want cap or do you want draft picks?
Let's go draft picks.
All right. So Los Angeles Lakers, four-year forecast, and then we'll go into the Suns in a second here. Four-year forecast for the Los Angeles Lakers is as told. They have their first-round pick this year. So you mentioned you think they're a playoff team, so that'll probably be, you know, between 15 and 18 with their pick because they're not going to be a great playoff team. They don't own their second rounder. That one actually would transfer over to the Milwaukee Bucks. They give up their 2015 first rounder and their 2015 second rounder. They keep them both in 2016. They give up their 2017 first rounder as long as it's outside of the top five to the Orlando Magic, and they keep their second rounder. So essentially, in the next 4 years, they have a grand total of two second-round picks, and 2 first-round picks. They get 1 first-round pick in the next 3 years, which is this year. So influx of youth that is willing to go there on a good contract is going to be tough for the Los Angeles Lakers going forward.
Yeah, that is definitely not a good position to be in the draft. But the Lakers have seemed to have some pretty decent success as far as NBA franchises go at getting talent to come to play for them outside of the draft.
Yeah, yeah. And when you look at the Phoenix Suns real quick, and then I'll let you share your thoughts a little bit more on that. The Suns this year could have as many as 4 picks. Are they going to get there? No. But they're basically going to get the Pacers pick. There's no way that team doesn't make the playoffs. Hey, by the way, Brightsiders, beginning of the season, when I said Indiana would be the best team in the league, and you guys said that they might not even make the playoffs, or they definitely won't even be in the top 5 teams in the league. I know it's a small sample size, but I'm right so far, so in your face. They get the Pacers pick. They get their pick. They might get Washington's pick. So potentially 3 first-rounders this year, all probably, though, going to be in that second half of the draft, like 14 to 20, and then obviously the Pacers pick. They get the Raptors' second-round pick this year. There's something's got to still change. There's fluidity there. But they looks like with the second round, they might end up with a pick or two. They get the Lakers' pick and their own pick in 2015, and then they have their own picks in 2016 and 2017. They've done a good job of keeping a hold of those. So in the next couple of years, they have as many as, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 first-round picks in the next 4 years, with obviously a logjam of those being in the next 2 years.
Yeah, that's the way I'm kind of seeing it. With the way things are working out, I think that they're going to – they have a really good shot to get at least 2 of those this year, and then I could see it to where it'd be a position where they might get the other 2 the following year. So I would guess that they'll get 6 in the next 2 years. I think at least 5 between this year and next year. So the Suns are going to be in a really good position to keep stocking this team with young talent and maybe even use some of those picks to do other things. Obviously, you don't need a complete roster full of young players like that, but there's also a lot of value in terms of those rookie deals. Being able to control players for those years on very cheap deals, especially if you can get draft well and get players that are going to produce right away, produce well, you get some of these young superstar type of talents or even just guys that can contribute, whether they're starters or whether they're playing in a good role as a reserve. Those are really cheap contracts. So those are some of the best contracts you can have in the NBA.
Yeah, and one thing that I like to consider when you start looking at the draft picks is it's one thing to go, hey, on paper we might have 5 picks in the next few years. None of them, I would imagine none of them are going to be top 10, top 5. So you're not really going to get one of the 5 picks or something like that at the top, but you're probably going to get a handful of picks in the middle of the draft. And if you can at least hit on 1 or 2 of those in terms of having maybe an NBA starter, Paul George going where he went in the draft and players like that ilk, if you can end up finding one of those kind of guys in the middle of the draft, you already have an Eric Bledsoe. You have either a tradable asset or Goran Dragic, right? You have quality talent already on the roster. You have Alex Len and Archie Goodwin. You have Miles Plumlee. You have the Morris twins that are playing very well and their contracts were picked up. So you have, I'm not saying that this team has the best talent of the teams that are kind of rebuilding and re-imaging themselves. But when you consider looking at teams like Utah, Milwaukee, New York, Sacramento, Orlando, Brooklyn, Philadelphia, Cleveland, Toronto, those kind of teams, yeah, probably about 3 or 4 of them have equal to potentially better, depending on your perspective, young talent currently on the roster, plus picks coming in the near future that'll be in the top 10. I think the Suns are in a good position. Whether Eric Bledsoe turns into a superstar or not, you traded Jared Dudley for him. Let's not forget that. You traded a role player who was the 4th or 5th best player on your team when you guys were really clicking, maybe even 5th or 6th best player, for a guy who has a chance to be maybe your 2nd or 3rd best player as you start progressing towards being a playoff team. I think this team is positioning themselves much better than the Lakers have. But then again, like you said, the Lakers don't rebuild, they reload. They're the Yankees of the NBA.
And wouldn't it be just pretty crazy, unfathomable, in just recent days, it wasn't that long ago, that you could look at it that the Suns might have 6 first-round draft picks this year and next year in the next 2 drafts, and none of them are a lottery pick.
That's insane. When Lance Blanks was running the ship, there was no chance I would have ever believed that.
So that's a possibility. The Suns have been playing good, and I'm gonna keep on saying that I think that they won't make the playoffs, that they're not good enough, because they seem to be very adroit at proving me wrong. And every time I say, oh, I think they're going to lose this game, and they go out and win it, or I think, oh, you know, it's about to run out, their momentum is going to, they're going to hit the wall, and they don't. So I'm going to keep saying that, and that way the Suns can keep proving me wrong and winning.
Yeah, yeah, and not to get too soapboxy, but, you know, if the Phoenix Suns finish, and obviously things change, players stay in college, other players get better, the Cleveland Cavaliers end up with draft picks and they do weird things, so things will change between now and then, but if the Phoenix Suns are drafting between 10 and 14, I'm not saying that all these guys are going to be studs, but you're looking at players that could be like, you know, Gary Harris, Andrew Harrison, Jeremy Grant, Noah Vonleh, Chris Walker, James Young, Wayne Selden, a lot of players that you might have seen a little bit in college, or you'll start seeing more when you start changing the channel that way in March. There's a lot of really good talent. I think this draft has about 6 or 7 guys that can go number one, which means that 6 or 7 or 5 or 6 guys are going to fall down into that 2 to 10 range. Some guys might even fall a little bit further because teams weren't anticipating them being there, and they just kind of go with the guy that they were actually looking at potentially getting. So if you fall in that 10 to 14 range in a draft like this, you could end up having a star fall in your lap because other teams just do absolutely ridiculous things. We see it year after year. Usually those teams are called the Cleveland Cavaliers. But if the Suns are in that range, I think they're okay. But if they finish in like that 14 to 17 range, like they're kind of flirting with right now, then, you know, things are a little different. It's a little harder to hit on those kind of picks. But the Suns are doing a good job of putting themselves in a position. I don't think very many people thought they'd be 11-9 at this point, basically, playing as well as they're playing and still having the potential to have 3 first-round picks in the most vaunted draft in 11 years.
I don't think that they, well, maybe they did, the people within the Suns organization, but I think this is even pretty good compared to where they were at, because they were very tight-lipped and close to the vest and didn't want to come out and make any bold predictions like their predecessors, like they'd done before, and where they had to take their lumps for that. So they were very cautious in their wording and talked about goals in terms of player improvement and making progress and stuff like that. And nobody ever said the word playoffs. And now it's going into the season a little bit more. But I don't know, you've been around the team more than me. Has there even been any talk of playoffs in there with the start? Because I don't think it's something I've heard.
And to go back to what you mentioned there, what you're alluding to, which was like media day in the very beginnings of the season last year, where there was a lot of hope. And I'm not knocking these guys for having it. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to project hope and potential out to the fan base to get the arena full, to give your team that kind of a, you know, an atmosphere to be able to go win in front of their home crowd. I don't knock them for doing that. But this year, you're right. I mean, to quote the infamous words of Alvin Gentry, or at least infamous to me, we're not trying to be the Lakers. And that was what Alvin said last year, whereas like the president, the GM, the coaching's other coaches, the players, they all thought they were vying for a playoff spot. Whereas this year, the very beginning of it all, at media day, at practices, at training camp, Ryan McDonough, Coach Hornacek, Lon Babbie, the players, they all were stuck with the same thing. This team is not going to be measured on wins and losses, which I think is one of the best little generic cookie-cutter statements to ever say if you're a rebuilding team. They're not going to measure success by wins and losses was the general statement they've had. And all season, I've been not trying to poke them to get them to say they're a playoff team. That's definitely not what I'm trying to do. But every time I ask them when they win a few games, they start getting hot and they're playing well, whether it's Gerald Green, PJ Tucker, Channing Frye, Goran Dragic, Eric Bledsoe, and his the way that he answers questions with 5 words or less, none of those guys will jump on and start committing to the playoffs. They all say that they think that they're better than what everyone gives them, you know, credit for being. They always thought they were better than what people were giving them credit for. But same thing with all the players. We're taking it one game at a time. we're trying to get better. We're just trying to work hard. We're just coming in here trying to be the best team we can be on a day-to-day basis. They got that football mentality of one game at a time, and I appreciate that. And none of those guys are getting cocky. None of them are getting confident. None of the conversations are going from we to I like normally it does when you're starting to lose. This team is actually holding it together, and playoffs is not something that they're talking about, at least publicly, or at least when I asked the question.
Yeah, I still see them as being a little bit outside of that picture, but they've obviously done things that I had not foreseen at the beginning of the season or even early into the season. So one name that I did notice that was conspicuously absent, at least it would be in the ties of one of our staff writers here, was that no Doug McDermott reference, no throw in there with the Suns picking maybe somewhere in that 10 to 18 range.
Oh, that's because Dougie Fresh there. Sorry, Jacob, but he and a few other names are starting to slip into that 20 to 30 range, maybe even early second round there. And that is not an insult to the player. That's more of a compliment to the depth and quality of this draft. When you have guys like Glenn Robinson III, Doug McDermott, and Mitch McGarry, just to throw out three names that everyone has probably heard of and watched, those three guys were projected lottery picks when the season started. Other players have played better than them, while those three are still playing really good basketball. Three of those guys have not played as well as some other folks, so those guys are going to fall down, and you might see the Suns draft them at 30. You might have all three of those guys on the board for the Suns at 30 after they've already drafted two really talented athletes with lots of potential that they're going to try and build around. So that's, again, another fun part of this draft.
Yeah, they'll definitely have some leverage, some flexibility to fill holes when that time comes around. So we got that, what they're going to do with the draft there, possibly, potentially. Now, what about free agency? I think you had maybe talked about cap. You had said we're going to look at cap. What are we going to look at with cap?
So let's put a cap on that for a second. And so to conclude the contest that we're doing here, it's going to be Kobe Bryant's points, comma, margin of victory, comma, who's going to win the game. So earlier I said Kobe will score 22 points. I'm going to say Kobe scores 22 points. I'm going to say the Suns win the game by 7, and that's all three. So I would, if I was in the comment section, I would put 22, 7, Suns win, or 22, Suns win by 7. We're smart enough folk around here to be able to get the gist of it. Jim, I'm going to put you on the spot here. 22, Suns win by 7. You had 24 points.
24. Lakers 3.
And I think that's what the game is going to be, and then free throws will end up deciding it. So I think we both have a close game coming down the stretch. I think free throws decide it for the Suns. I think they're up by a few to end the game there. So let's go into, without continuing too much on that, let's go into the cap as we were talking about. So the draft picks, the Lakers, not so good. You're right. They didn't do a great job with managing their draft picks. They traded a potential, good pick next year. We'll see what happens with it for Steve Nash, who has played just a handful of games for them in general, it feels like. And it's kind of sad ending to his career where we're going with that. But next year, they have committed to the cap. They have Kobe Bryant and his very, very humble contract that he signed. They have Steve Nash's contract, his final year. They have a player option for Nick Young. So unless he's going to get more than 1.2 on the market, I'd imagine he picks that up. And they got the best towel-waving big man that's now starting to start, Robert Sacre. So they're committed to about $35 million, give or take, $35.3 million against the cap. Gives them, with the cap being about 54-ish, am I doing that right? I'm not a capologist by no means. So if it's about 54, then we're talking about the team having about $29 million, give or take. Somewhere in that range, they're going to have a quality amount of money to go out there and go sign a max player. But if they go sign a max player, then they can't really fill out a roster. So it's going to be interesting with them. I just realized how bad my math was there. So it's a little bit closer to about $19 million or so. But that's where they're at with the cap. The Lakers, for as bad as they were with the draft picks, they actually made up for it with being very favorable with the cap and doing a good job with making it to where it's Kobe Bryant, Steve Nash, and then an empty roster.
Yeah, that's basically what they have there. And I'd even heard some discussion about them possibly stretching Nash to to relieve themselves of the burden of his salary a little bit, possibly. And obviously there's already been some murmurings, dark shadows in dark corners of Carmelo Anthony possibly being a name that might be interested in going to play in L.A., which to me would be the most hilarious scenario possible, because not only are there not enough basketballs in a game for Kobe and Carmelo, there aren't enough basketballs in the world for those two guys on the same team. I think that that would be a completely odd couple. I think that it's really hard. The Nash and Kobe thing didn't work, but Kobe's obviously had some success playing with other teammates. He's won titles in two different teams, basically, being 1A, however you want to look at it. Some people think that Shaq was the better player, but obviously that was kind of a 1-1A situation, and Kobe was obviously the best player on the second iteration of his championship runs. But Carmelo doesn't seem to have much luck in finding anybody that he can play well with, that he can actually make better, that Carmelo could be included in one of those children's books, being one of the characters in that book that has a hard time sharing the ball with the other kids.
Yeah, it's kind of, whenever you start thinking about super teams and going back to the Chris Paul, you know, trade that almost happened, I'm almost wondering if David Stern, with doing that, did everybody a favor, because I don't know how well Kobe will ever be able to play with a perimeter player or any player that demands the ball equally, if not more, than he does. And that's not a knock on Kobe, because he's won championships and he's up there in the all-time scorers list, and he's one of the top 10 to 12 players to ever play the game, or higher, depending on how you value his game. I think he's definitely in that top 10 to 12 for sure, and might end up being a little bit higher when all things are said and done. He's a great player. But he's one of those guys where I don't know if he necessarily would have been great with a ball-dominant point guard. You saw how the team struggled last year before Nash got hurt when those two had to share the ball. And it takes time. You got to get used to things. The first year of Miami, when they brought in Wade and LeBron together, that team struggled. But the crazy thing about those guys struggling with how great LeBron is, and the fact that he's in his prime, not in his late 30s, is that their version of struggling is losing in the NBA Finals in six games. So that wasn't obviously what happened with the Lakers last year. I'm kind of glad they didn't get Steve Nash. That they didn't get Chris Paul, that unfortunately Steve Nash's career is ending the way it's ending. But I don't know how well Kobe would have played, let alone with a great point guard that would have set him up. But then on the other side of the coin, with a great scorer that would have demanded the ball equally, if not more, than he would. I would want the ball in Carmelo's hands more than I would want it in Kobe's hands in terms of creating offense and scoring, because he's more in his prime and he's a more pure scorer at this level of the game.
Right. And I'm sure that the Lakers fans are probably already expecting that LeBron's going to opt out and take his talents to Hollywood, because they're a bunch of entitled individuals that think that the basketball world revolves around them. But I don't necessarily see that happening. I don't know whether they might be able to make some moves, even possibly before the trade deadline, where they have a bunch of expiring contracts. So, for instance, they could have participated in something like the Rudy Gay trade, where they could have sent Pau Gasol's expiring to Toronto for Rudy Gay, because it seemed like that's basically, for the most part, what Toronto was trying to do, was just dump Rudy Gay's salary. So the Lakers could have participated in something like that. So maybe that's a way that they can get a player in that way. But they definitely have a bunch of expiring contracts, a bunch of cap space, and playing in L.A., whether you like the Lakers or not, it is an attractive location. It's an attractive destination. One of, if not the most premier destination to play in the league.
Yeah, and I'll take it a step further. Not only do they expect LeBron to go there, they expect LeBron to go there and maybe take an $8 million contract, you know, $8 million per year for like 3 years, and, you know, go there. Don't take the money, be unselfish, and take less money to win a championship, because that's kind of what guys do out in L.A., is they take less money to try and win championships versus taking more money. I think we get what I'm saying there. So now let's switch over to the Suns. And here's the funny thing about the Suns. What did I say the Lakers' number was? It was about $35, $36 million in cap space spent, and they're going to have two or three players on their roster. Room to go get more guys, but we saw what happens when you have cap space and you don't get the guy. You end up having to bring in Xavier Henry, you bring in Wesley Johnson, you bring in all these different guys to come in and fill the spots, Nick Young, et cetera, et cetera. The Phoenix Suns, on the other hand, they have about $30 to $36 million in committed cap space for next year. They obviously got to back the truck up and dump some money on Eric Bledsoe if they want to keep him. But this is a team that has a full roster, young players. The way that they disperse their contracts is a little bit tough to maybe make some splashy moves. Most of their contracts skew between $1 and $3 million outside of the Channing Frye deal and the Goran Dragic deal, which is 7.5 and 6.8 respectively. But hey, if Channing picks up his player option and he's here next year, they basically bring back the entire team again. They got to, like I said, they got to dump the truck over on Eric Bledsoe, but they might lose Kravtsov. They might lose Ish Smith. They got to, pay P.J. Tucker a little bit more than they're paying him. And Deontay Christmas is a potential expiring as well. So they got three or four things that they got to kind of fix. I think P.J. is a manageable guy to be able to get him back here. He'll be a manageable number. And Eric Bledsoe, if they decide to dump the money on him, great. If they don't dump the money on him, then maybe they can facilitate some kind of a sign-and-trade. That way they can get something for Dudley, if you want to think of it from an assets perspective, because they did trade him for Dudley. So They're in an equal position as the Lakers in cap space, but the thing is they actually have a roster of players and basically the same roster that's currently 11-9.
Yeah, we've already seen that McDonough has no problem with rearranging the furniture in the lobby. So none of these guys are really planted here. Any of this is all very transmutable, but really, like you had said, with Bledsoe, if they do back up the dump truck, then the Suns are around that 35. Well, now they're up to about 45, because instead of the 3.5, he's going to be getting about 13.5. PJ Tucker is going to be making more than $1 million. So now you're getting closer to 48. You're getting closer to 50. The Suns aren't going to be in a position to sign a max player like the Lakers are. If they're going to get some kind of deal in the workings to bring some kind of transcendent talent, one of these top 10, top 20 in the league players to come play and try to put the cherry on top of this Sunday that they're putting together here, they're going to have to move some contracts, move some money to do that. So they have, like you said, a more complete roster. They've got better assets. They've got better talent in terms of personnel. They've got better contracts in terms of what they can trade. They've got better draft picks. But they don't have just that bottomless well of cap space to where they can go out and throw the boat at somebody in free agency.
So question for you, and this is just a preference question. It's not based on any logistics or any numbers or anything like that. Just based on when you watch Eric Bledsoe play, Drew Holiday got his extension for about $11 million per year. Ty Lawson's has kickers every year of about $900,000, but it started off at about $10.6 million, I believe, and it goes up to $11 and change, $12 and change, $13 and change to end. So all of them have that one has kickers. Then you have someone like Jeff Teague, who got $8 million a year on his extension. You have other players that made different amounts as well. With Stephen Curry got his extension recently as well, and that one's about 10, starts off at 10.6 and has kickers again that go up every single year. When you watch Eric Bledsoe, is he in that $8 million Jeff Teague range? Is he in that $11 million Drew Holiday range? Is he in that $12 to $13 million where Ty Lawson and Steph Curry kind of fall? What are you willing to pay him this offseason?
I don't think he's as good as Curry, but they got a bargain basement price on that. They were able to get him at just a steal of a deal based off of, I think, some health issues, stuff like that going in, because Curry's a hell of a ball player. But he's probably, in terms of what he's going to get paid and what you're worth is what the market dictates. So in terms of that, he's probably worth I if he keeps playing the way he is and can average 18 points, 6 assists, 5 rebounds, 2 steals, somewhere in that neighborhood, somebody's probably going to throw him the max deal. So somebody's going to throw him the stupid money, and the Suns will have to match if they want to keep him. But I'd rather spend my money elsewhere, because unless you're getting somebody like Chris Paul or Russell Westbrook, then it's not worth, for me, paying at the point guard position. You can get somebody serviceable like Goran, who can do just fine for you, and save your money for a difference maker at another position. I don't think point guards win championships. And to tie up $13 million, $14 million of your cap space, of that valuable, limited commodity, that limited resource, on a player like Eric Bledsoe that I do not think is in that top five, top three type of point guard echelon, would be, I think, a very bad allotment of the Suns' resources. So what he's worth in terms of NBA terms, probably that max deal. What he's worth to me is that I do a sign and trade some way to get rid of him. I wouldn't give him the money.
Yeah, and see, that's where I think things will get interesting towards the end of the season. I agree. I think I've said this before. I'm trying to remember. I don't know what I said last time. Hopefully it's the same thing I'm saying right now, because I don't want to be that guy that flip-flops. So I think I said this last time, that the most I would give him on a per year is probably about 11, 12-ish. Like, I don't know if he's a better all-around basketball player than Steph Curry and Ty Lawson. I don't know if he's better than them. I can actually come out and say I don't think he's better than Curry at all. And I think him and Lawson can be a debate after maybe we get a year or two of Bledsoe playing. But I don't know if he's a better basketball player than those guys, and those guys are getting what they're getting. We know that Eric Bledsoe is a better athlete than all of them, no questions asked. The guys are running back, playing basketball. He's a bull. He's kind of a freak with that baby LeBron nickname. That definitely fits when you watch him play. I don't know if he's worth that amount of money, and that's why if you're Ryan McDonough, you play it safe and you sign him, and then you try and facilitate a trade. Let's say, just throwing out a scenario, you have three things you can do. You can let him walk for nothing, you can trade him in a sign-and-trade, or you can sign him to pretty comparable tradable money and then maybe facilitate a trade within the next 18 months. And a team like Orlando, let's say Orlando, the ping-pong balls don't bounce right. They fall to like 7 or 8. They don't get Marcus Smart. They don't get any of the point guards that they really, really like. And all of a sudden, they're itching for a point guard to run their offense with Victor Oladipo. And they look over at Eric Bledsoe, and Ryan McDonough picks up the phone and goes, yeah, we want that player, that player, that player. They got boatloads of good young ones, by the way, if you haven't looked at their roster. We want those three and a lottery-protected first-round pick. Why not? And then all of a sudden, you trade Eric Bledsoe, and you bring in more assets. You revamp the roster. You add more young talent. So, hey, I mean, if he ends up earning a contract of that size and we keep him, great. But I think the worst thing that could happen is you sign him to good money and he doesn't necessarily meet our expectations, but a trade can be facilitated. It just takes one team to like what you do. We just saw Rudy Gay get traded. Nothing is impossible in this league.
Right. And like you were saying, Steph Curry, that guy is absolutely stealthy. He's averaging 22 points and 9 assists this year. 550 effective field goal percentage, shooting 90% from the line. So I think that he's in a slightly different tier than Eric Bledsoe in terms of what Bledsoe is putting up for the Suns. Just a little bit different. And both of those players I would actually take well before Rudy Gay. I would take them before Rudy Gay if the pay was equal. And Rudy Gay makes just a little bit more money than those two players. He actually makes more than both of them combined by quite a bit right now, and will still make nearly as much as the two of them combined even after Bledsoe gets his new contract.
Yeah, so for the future of the Suns, that's kind of where this all started. Future of the Suns versus future of the Lakers, because they're playing tonight as you're listening to this on a Tuesday. I honestly, when you look at it, it comes down to the wild card of, do the Lakers get a max contract player? I personally don't think they will. I think the allure and the luster of going over to the Los Angeles Lakers is not as sexy as it used to be. Kind of the same thing. It's one of those things where, to make the comparison to the Dallas Mavericks, everybody wants to play for Mark Cuban. Everybody loves Mark Cuban from afar. Everybody thinks he's a great owner because he spends money, he's funny, and he's charismatic. But then at the end of the day, the players go and they sign with Pat Riley. The players go and sign with Danny Ainge. The players go and sign with different general managers, presidents, owners that they know for sure know basketball, that are about winning championships, that are, you know, when they get into the meeting, they're not, you know, Mark Cuban's personality. Everyone loves Mark Cuban. I think that's kind of what LA is turning into, where you'll hear every free agent go, yeah, LA is great. I'd love to live there. Oh, Hollywood. Oh, the beach. You know, San Diego's right there. Vegas is right there. What a great place to live and play basketball. Oh, my contract's up. I'm going to go sign with a team where I might be able to win a title with. I don't think that's happening in LA. We saw it with Dwight Howard. We saw it with LeBron in the free agency as recently, you know, a few years ago when he went to Miami. I don't know if players necessarily will actually go to Los Angeles versus the concept of talking about how amazing it would be. I think that's kind of gone away.
But so here's a conundrum, a little bit of a paradox almost. You'll like this. I'll lay this out for you and you'll see where I'm going. So from what you just delineated there, what you're kind of expressing, who would you rather be right now? What position would you rather be in? The Phoenix Suns or the Los Angeles Lakers? Who do you think is in the better position moving forward?
Personally, so if you're asking me, I would say that I feel the Phoenix Suns are in a better position going forward as a franchise.
Okay, now let me say this now. With that being said, and I would say actually with the way everything is, I agree with you right at this moment. But now here, to be devil's advocate, to actually, you know, I'm probably going to piss a couple of people off here, but that's the way I roll.
Go for it.
Who do you think wins an NBA title first, the next NBA champion between those two teams? Do you think the Lakers will win a title before the Suns, or do you think the Suns will win a title before the Lakers?
Oh, see, no, I see exactly what you're doing there with that. And to be honest, I think the Suns are a couple of steps ahead of the Lakers, but I think both the teams are in the middle to the kind of the bottom top half of the middle of the NBA standing. So honestly, I don't think the Suns are positioning themselves to win a title anytime in the near future until they hit on their star. I would say the Lakers have a better chance of hitting on that star. Yeah, I think the Suns are in a better position to long-term be a better consistent franchise, but logic says the Lakers are the team that's going to win the championship next because they have that proven track record.
It's harder for the Suns. It's harder for teams like the Suns. The Lakers just have those advantages. I mean, they can screw stuff up. If the Suns screwed stuff up as bad as the Lakers have done with this whole, you know, the last couple of years with everything they've done, then it'd be one of those things where people bemoan, you make those mistakes and you're bad for 10 years. Well, that's not going to happen to the Lakers. They just have so many inherent advantages. So, yeah, so I agree. I think that the Suns have a lot more going with them organizationally, talent, flexibility, draft picks, everything going in terms of that. But then at the end of the day, it's still the Lakers.
Yeah, very hard to disagree with you on that one. So in the common theme of 48, Jim, give us your parting words in the last 4 to 8 seconds here so we can end this podcast, ironically, at the 48-minute mark.
I'm looking forward to this game. Some people are probably already sick of all the Kobe Bryant talk, and that's a lot of the people on this side, probably some of the people listening to this podcast, but it's a huge story around the league, and I'm not one of those people that's sick of it. I really get up for these games against the Lakers. I enjoy watching Kobe Bryant play, and he's one of my favorite people in the entire league for the Suns to beat. I love those games against the Lakers. Some of my favorite games ever were the 2006 playoffs, that series against him, the clothesline, the Tim Thomas three, the overtime, Kobe Bryant dropping 50, the Suns blowing him out, Kobe quitting. I can vividly remember watching him quit. I remember where I was when Tim Thomas hit that three. I was sitting at a bar in Las Vegas. So that was great. So I have great memories, and I hope to, you know, see some more, and hopefully the Suns will turn this around while Kobe Bryant is falling to pieces, and I'll enjoy Kobe while he's good, and I'd love to see the Suns get the upper hand on him, and when Kobe is limping off into the sunset, the Suns are hitting full stride going for another championship.
This podcast may or may not have ended in 48 minutes or more. That's the end of the Phoenix Suns podcast here. That's episode 48. Hope you guys enjoyed. Share, tell a friend, yada yada. We'll be back next week with more Phoenix Suns podcasts.